It's the morning show coming to you from our Superior Bureau. I'm Kate Archer Kent. And together with our colleagues at the National Program to the Best of Our Knowledge, the morning show has been exploring the concept of hope this month. And today we're focused on the hope that space provides. We're talking about how space flight is getting less expensive, space explorers are thinking bolder, and Mars just may be habitable with some smart human engineering. As if, you know, we can create a living world on the red planet that could unlock the secrets of our universe. Do you follow this? What questions do you have about this mission and how it would work? How do you think our world would change if we reached the red planet? Would it inspire you? Would it motivate you? Would it give you hope? Join in with your questions, your thoughts on Mars at 800-642-1234. Robert Zubrin is an astronautical engineer. He's an author who advocates for the exploration of Mars. His new book is called The Case for Space, How the Revolution in Spaceflight Opens Up a Future of Limitless Possibility. And he's president of Pioneer Astronautics and the Mars Society. Robert, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you've been writing books about space exploration and Mars specifically for decades now. You kind of carry the Mars mantle. How has this become your lifeblood, your life work?
Well, actually, it goes way, way back. I was five when Sputnik flew, and I was already reading science fiction. And while to the adults, Sputnik may have been terrifying, to me, it was exhilarating because it meant that these stories that I was reading about the spacefaring future were going to be real. And I was all in. And, you know, in the 60s, it picked up. I was nine when Kennedy made his speech committing us to go to the moon. I saw that on TV from my fourth grade classroom. And we were going to the moon by 1970, Mars by 1980, Saturn by 1990, Alpha Centauri by the year 2000. And I wanted to be part of it. And of course, the only part of that program that actually happened was we did make it to the moon by 1970. But in 1968, there was a change in administrations. Nixon came in, and even as the astronauts were landing on the moon, he was destroying the program. And NASA had plans to land on Mars by 1981. They were canceled. And frankly, the human spaceflight program has been adrift ever since. And for a while, I accepted that. I became a high school science teacher. But then in the early 80s, I said, no, this isn't what I wanted to be. I went back to school, got advanced degrees in engineering, and then went into the business as an astronautical engineer and was able to make some contributions in figuring out how we could get to Mars with present-day technology. And that's when I started writing books.
You were kind of off that timeline of getting to Mars by 1981, a little bit behind on that trajectory. Where do you see us now in moving toward Mars?
Well, what's happened is, while the political class has lost its way, or precisely because the political class has lost its way, new players have stepped in. And now we have an entrepreneurial space race going on. I mean, it's been led by Elon Musk, SpaceX. And what they've done is they've shown that it is possible for an entrepreneurial team, well-led, to do things that previously was thought that only the governments of major powers could do. And not only that, do them in one-third the time at one-tenth the cost, and this is happening. And while NASA has no real plan to get to Mars, I mean, they claim they have one for 2033, but in fact, it's not a real plan at all. It's just a vision. Musk is making hardware, and I think if he doesn't trip up, and of course he could because he skates close to the edge of the ice, but if he doesn't trip up, SpaceX will land people on Mars before the end of the 2020s. And this is going to happen. And if he does trip up, there's dozens of others that have entered the race inspired by his example. And not only in the United States, but in China and Ukraine and New Zealand and everywhere. The fact that this has been made into a private race has made it possible for people who come from countries that don't have major space programs to participate. And this is happening.
Well, it sounds as if privatization of space exploration could be a good thing to get the ball rolling, but could it mean private colonization, that once you arrive, private companies have first dibs at what they find?
Well, to a point, but if you may recall your history, that is how the United States was first colonized. The Jamestown Colony was sponsored by the British West India Company, and there was a private corporation behind the Pilgrims as well. But very quickly, once the colonists were here, they said, "We're not here for you. We're here for us." And so, in the end of the day, Mars is going to belong to the Martians, not to some corporation that sponsors them in the hope of realming a profit out of them.
We're talking about how making it to Mars could help us discover more about Earth and expand our human potential, maybe even give us newfound hope. The book is called The Case for Space. Robert Zubrin is our guide, and he's been making a passionate case for going to Mars for decades. How do you think our world would change if we reached Mars? Are you concerned about the cost of space travel? What about private companies working on space travel? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Robert, your book lays out a number of reasons why we should travel to Mars, which we're going to get into. But first, how would we actually do that? What would, like, half of the world's population just board a ship to the red planet?
No. This thing will happen in a number of phases. First, there'll be exploration missions involving just a few people, possibly as few as four on the first mission, maybe five or six. Then we'll establish a base, and now you might have 20 or 30 people and staying on Mars, not just for a year, but for long durations. And in the course of things, as the base develops the technologies that allows us to take Martian materials and turn them into useful resources to make fuel and oxygen, to extract water, to grow food, to make ceramics and plastics and glass and metals and all sorts of things made out of them, people will become increasingly self-sufficient. The logistic costs of supporting people on Mars will become less and less. It will become possible to have a larger and larger base population. People that decide to stay at the base inevitably will form relationships. Children will be born, and you'll start having new branches of human civilization born out of those seed crystals. And by the way, I think that there won't just be one base. There's room on Mars for more than one flag. There's room on Mars for more than one culture. I think we'll see several new branches of human civilization established on Mars. And while they'll take their point of departure from whatever nation sponsored them, they will evolve in their own direction from there.
We understand how a variety of the Earth's phenomena work, but how would exploring Mars, traveling to Mars, give us a knowledge of what we're missing about our own planet?
Well, okay. So one of the reasons to go to Mars and to go into space more broadly is for the science. And we've learned an awful lot of science from going into space, and actually even before we went into space, from looking into space. Most of our knowledge of physics has actually come from astronomy, because the universe is a giant lab where things can be demonstrated that we can't do in a lab that we build ourselves. We learned the law of gravity and classical physics and electromagnetism and relativity and nuclear fusion from the astronomy. Now, in terms of what's up for grabs right now, okay, let's take Mars. Mars was a warm and wet planet for its first billion years. It was really a twin to the Earth before they went in separate directions. Now, it was a warm and wet planet for five times as long as it took life to appear on Earth after there was liquid water here. So if the theory is correct that life evolves from chemistry wherever it can, it should have appeared on Mars.
And we have to pause right there with aerospace engineer Robert Zubrin, who says Mars has all the resources needed to support life. Let's join in. Call us, tweet us. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about going to Mars and what the future holds. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're getting a step-by-step vision on how to get to Mars. Along the way, it's the laws of physics with equations Astronautical engineer Robert Zubrin stays with us, and he says we can create a living world on Mars, and question is, would it be ethical to do it? Would it be ethical not to? Join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think our world would change if we reached the red planet? Would it inspire you, motivate you, give you hope? The book is called The Case for Space, How the Revolution in Spaceflight Opens Up a Future of Limitless Possibility. And author Robert Zubrin stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Dave joining us from Oshkosh. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I guess I just would like to maybe push back a little bit on the guest here as Mars as a valid second option for colonizing. I could see it as a strategic jumping off point, but this is not a habitable planet. It would take thousands of years of terraforming, and it's only really habitable in a small area along the equator, not to mention the giant storms that occur there. It's just not really a feasible option.
What do you say there to Dave? Yeah.
Okay. Well, I would say that, you know, when Jefferson did the Louisiana Purchase, critics said that much of the territory that he had bought was uninhabitable, including Colorado, where I currently live, was turned part of what they called the Great American Desert, by which they meant not so much a desert with cactuses and just sand, but a place that you couldn't farm, and they couldn't with those techniques that they had at the time. Not enough rainfall. You get 10 inches of rainfall a year here. But look, we live in a science fiction universe today. We routinely fly across the ocean in ships that travel at 500 miles an hour through the air, and I mean, to someone 200 years ago, this is absolute fantasy. I mean, these Boeing 747s weigh as much as sailing ships of that time did, but instead of traveling at 5 miles an hour tops, they travel at 500. And all the rest, and we communicate through the air from the other side of the world, and even can look at with video phones now, and all of this. The estimates that it will take thousands of years to terraform Mars are based on a notion of current human technological capabilities, which will be dwarfed 100 years from now by what they have then. What we have now will seem primitive. But to the point, Mars was once a warm and wet planet. It can be made so again. Actually, we're demonstrating the ability to alter a planet's climate right now. Global warming, not what the Earth needs, but it's what Mars needs. And if we really wanted to do global warming on purpose, we know about greenhouse gases that are far more potent than CO2, and which thousands of times more potent. And if we were to manufacture them on Mars with an industrial plant, frankly, that would need about as much power as the city of Chicago currently uses, we could warm Mars by 10 centigrade within 50 years. And that would cause massive amounts of carbon dioxide to outgas out of the soil. It would thicken Mars' atmosphere, completely change the climate. It would water that's frozen into the Martian soil would start to melt and flow. You know, we discovered glaciers on Mars as far south as 38 degrees north, which is like San Francisco, that have more water than the American Great Lakes. This stuff would melt, and the dry rivers on Mars would flow again. We can do this. We can not just bring life to Mars. We can bring Mars to life. And this would be the most magnificent creative effort. No one would be able to look at it and not feel prouder to be human.
Dave, are you open to the possibility after hearing this?
Yeah, I think he made some really great points. The only thing that I would say regarding the Louisiana Purchase is there was life existing in that area already. I mean, whether it be small plants and life, you know, reptiles or whatever, there was life. There isn't on Mars.
Dave, thanks so much for the call. There isn't life on Mars. Robert Zubrin.
Well, actually, there may be life on Mars, but not substantial life of the type that David is probably thinking about, plants and animals and so forth. No, there's no active biosphere on the Martian surface. There probably are microbes in the Martian groundwater because that's where they would have retreated. And to get back when the surface deteriorated, but my point, we could learn what life is by looking at them. All Earth life is the same at the biochemical level. We all use the same genetic language, RNA, DNA, the same information system, the same alphabet, if you will. Now, is that what life is, or is that just one example drawn from a much vaster tapestry of possibilities? If we can discover what life is, the advances we might be able to make in biology and the medical sciences could be absolutely astonishing.
Well, as we look at the research out there, NASA-sponsored research and development has given numerous technologies, the most famous being Velcro, Teflon, Tang. We've gained a lot more important technologies, of course, in computer science and agriculture, medicine. But can you give us can you give us a scope of what advances you'd expect if we attempted missions to Mars?
Well, what I actually think is the best, if you want to look at the here and now, the spin-off to us of the space program, there's been these particular advances that you've identified. But the bigger payoff has been the intellectual capital generated. You know, the number of science graduates in the United States in the 1960s doubled at every level, high school, college, PhD. In fact, it tripled at the PhD level. And that was a direct result of the Apollo program, which said to every young, at that time, boy, but now it would be boys and girls because things have changed, learn your science and you can be a pioneer of new worlds. And out of that, we got literally millions of young scientists, engineers, inventors, technological entrepreneurs, medical researchers. And these people have been paying us back for that ever since in every field. I mean, who were the technological entrepreneurs that built Silicon Valley in the 1990s? They were the 10-year-old little boy mad scientists building the robots and making rocket fuel in the basement in the 1960s. And, that's the payoff. The payoff is intellectual capital. The wealth of a nation is based on its intellectual capital. And from that, yes, there's been these specific programs that have produced specific innovations that NASA can be traced to. But in the broader economy, the payoff has been vastly more. It's totally dwarfed the expenditure on Apollo. And furthermore, the United States has benefited from this in terms of immigrants. The bright people from around the world have come here to be part of our space program because in Europe, unfortunately, for example, and Australia, and too many countries have said to their young people, you want to be a space explorer, emigrate. Well, we have profited from that immensely.
But aren't there less expensive, less risky ways to inspire kids to pursue STEM careers?
Actually, I don't think there are. Not to this extent. There's nothing as remarkable as this. Youth loves adventure. And space makes science the adventure. Not football. Not, something else. And this gets the greatest spirits move on the basis of this. Inspiration, putting a spirit in someone. I was once an associate editor of a child science magazine. We'd have a contest every month for kids. We do design your own solar stove. We'd get 12 entries. We said design a spacecraft for a mission to Mars. We get 300 entries.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with Adam in Madison. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
What's on your mind about Mars?
So, well, I called earlier and I thought this was going to be addressed. So I just think that based on what I've heard about Mars exploration and the cost of pursuing this and the things that NASA are doing and Elon Musk, that money could be so much better served. We have so many problems here, global warming, we've got cancer, we've got diabetes, we've got a plethora of health issues, pollution. We haven't figured out our own energy system, how we can utilize properly solar, because there's problems with solar, there's problems with wind, there's a variety of things. It just seems very silly to me to put the money that they are talking about towards things that are very extraneous to instead of fixing and making
things
much more efficient
on our planet here. Adam, thanks for that point. Robert Zubrin, Adam's pointing out a number of issues that need to be addressed on our own planet. Why don't we stick to home and work on those problems?
Well, I'm not against working on all sorts of problems, but we're spending less than 0.1% of our GDP on space. And if we take advantage of this entrepreneurial space revolution to lower costs, then we can easily land people on Mars within 10 years within NASA's existing budget. So we're not talking about breaking the bank to do this. But I would point out to the caller, okay, we wouldn't even know about the greenhouse effect if not for the space program, because we discovered it first on Venus. We wouldn't have solar panels because they were developed first for space, okay? And all these other problems that he brought up and many others can best be addressed by people who have scientific educations. And the space program has proven to be a massive engine for generating intellectual capital. We're not going to get superior performance in the schools by testing the kids to death, you know, as the current educational establishment seems to think we can.
We have to pause right there. Robert Zubrin, our guide, author of the new book, Advocating for the Exploration of Mars, The Case for Space. You can join in 800-642-1234 as we continue this conversation to find out how Mars exploration would advance humanity. News is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Here with us on the morning show as we come to you this week from our Superior Bureau. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Mars Society President Robert Zubrin writes that humans are the stewards of terrestrial life, and as we spread out first to Mars and then to the nearby stars, we must and shall bring life to many worlds and many worlds to life. Is this inspirational to you? Do you think our humanity is capable of this astronomical trajectory? Join in this hour's discussion at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called The Case for Space, How the Revolution in Spaceflight Opens Up a Future of Limitless Possibility. And author Robert Zubrin stays with us as we explore Mars and beyond. Let's go back to the phones now with Joan joining us from Madison. Hi, Joan.
Good morning. Yes, I have a question about the human being on Mars. It's already been proven that the human in space affects our bones and blood. And if you go, and that hasn't been that far out into space, but if you go to Mars, the mushy human being, how are they going to live outside of the space suit? It's disastrous for our bodies, the human being. Has he got an answer for that?
Thank you, Joan. What would the impact be to the human body?
Okay, well, the health effects that we've seen in space have resulted from zero gravity, which you don't get the same workout you get just from walking around and carrying out routine activities on Earth. You're carrying around, depending on your weight, say 150 pounds, and without that, the bones and muscles deteriorate unless you actually consciously exercise to a great extent. And in addition, the blood moves to different parts of the body and sets off various endocrine signals that cause things to go off. But on Mars, there is one-third gravity. Okay, so it's not zero. The blood will not migrate to the wrong parts of the body, and you'll get some degree of workout from routine activities, and more if you're walking around outside wearing a spacesuit. Now, yes, sure, we can't live outside on Mars today without a spacesuit. We'll have to live either inside of the spacecraft or in underground vaults that we build the size of subway systems or in domes on the surface. Eventually, of course, we'll terraform Mars, and we will be able to go outside. But the health effects that we've seen in space have come from zero gravity, not incidentally from radiation. There's been no real observed effects from radiation, but there has been marked effects from zero gravity, and they're the same effects you would get if all you did was lie in bed for 6 months. And so they can be countered by exercise or by artificial gravity, and to some extent by Martian gravity.
Well, let's go back to the phones now with David joining us from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yes, I just pointed out that Nixon kind of cut the whole Apollo program back then. He also cut a nuclear program over at Oak Ridge, a molten salt reactor. If he didn't do that, we probably would have a colony on Mars today we would have this molten salt reactor has a lot less radioactivity and all this stuff. We'd have clean power and probably not global warming, and the stuff that we learned about how to sustainable things would do a lot to help us deal with this climate and knowing how to keep systems going.
Well, David, it seems like there's a lot of 2020 hindsight here.
I know. But
well, no, he's right. And look, I mean, this was a massive failure of vision. This was like Christopher Columbus coming back from the New World the first time and said, hey, I've discovered a new continent, and Ferdinand and Isabella saying, oh, so what? Who cares? Get lost. Let's burn the ship. That's basically what Nixon did. And it was punitive. He really did a wrecking job on the program because it had been a Kennedy-Johnson affair. They went so far as to give the plans for the Saturn V rocket to the Boy Scout paper drive in Huntsville, Alabama. And yes, also what he said is true. The Democratic Party used to be pro-nuclear, the party of Roosevelt and Truman and JFK and Johnson, and they were advancing nuclear technology greatly. And one of them was, yes, this molten salt reactor, that the fuel could be continuously processed, there'd be much less nuclear waste, no net plutonium product. They killed that program too. So this was outrageous. And, there's a role in for progress in both the entrepreneurial and the government sector. And we had this tremendous thing going on in the 50s and 60s in terms of efforts on both fronts. And the Nixon basically wrecked the government program for progress. He wrecked the Atomic Energy Commission.
A tangent perhaps to David's thoughts there. How would our energy technology change if we were able to travel to and populate Mars?
Well, here's the thing. We can travel to Mars without novel energy technology, but it will be tremendously beneficial to the Martians to advance energy technology because, for example, you could make fossil fuels on Mars, but you would need energy to make them. So I think nuclear technology and probably fusion technology would be a big imperative for the Martians to develop. The deuterium, the isotope of hydrogen that is the fuel for fusion reactors, is six times as common on Mars as it is on Earth. And in general, I think Mars would be a pressure cooker for invention, and not just energy, but in ultra-productive crops, because they're going to be doing greenhouse agriculture, in robotics, because they have a labor shortage, in all sorts of areas. I think this is how Mars is going to benefit the Earth in one of the same ways that America has benefited humankind the most. Being a frontier society, we've become a pressure cooker for invention, and those inventions have spread around the world. America has fed the world, but not so much with its food exports as with its agricultural technology that we've developed and has spread elsewhere.
We're talking with Robert Zubrin. He is an aerospace engineer, author who advocates for exploration of Mars. The new book is called The Case for Space. You can join in. Do you want the government and NASA to attempt the Mars feat, or should it be a private company mission? What questions do you have about private companies like SpaceX that are making technical gains? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Nate now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I actually support the idea fully. And part of the reason why is because in a long time from now, thankfully, the sun is going to expand, and when that happens, the planet Earth is going to get cooked. And in order for life on Earth to survive, unless we actually move the planet, it'll have to become life from Earth. And colonizing Mars would be one more step along that way. If somebody wanted to look at it like a business investment, it would probably take a little while to pay off, but in the long run, it would. And on top of that, people, trees, and everything else we have with us here would still be alive, hopefully, somewhere in the future.
So Nate sees long-term gains in an investment now. Robert Zubrin?
Well, I think survival is a reason. Carl Sagan used to say all species either become spacefaring or extinct. I think there's much nearer term threats. You know, last December 18th, a small asteroid hit the Earth. It landed it exploded over the Bering Sea with a force 10 times that of the Hiroshima bomb. And these things happen. In my book, The Case for Space, I show a map of hits since 1994, and there's about a dozen of this magnitude. And of course, and then there's the historic hits that have caused mass extinctions. Now, I don't think we should go into space to try to flee these impacts. I think we should go into space to gain control over them. If we become spacefaring, we'll be able to deflect asteroids and protect the Earth. So, no, the reason to go into space is not to desert the Earth, but to protect the Earth and to add additional branches of human civilization to supplement our ingenuity and abilities to protect and life and expand its presence throughout the galaxy.
Well, and research shows that the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs was not unique. Why do you think the Earth might experience an event like this again?
Well, precisely because it's not unique, precisely because we have experienced it many times in the past. The one that the dinosaurs was a big one. There was an even bigger one that actually wiped out the animals that preceded the dinosaurs. In Arizona, there's a gigantic crater that anyone can visit and see, and that was an impact comparable in energy to a nuclear war. And that probably caused a widespread extinctions across the North American continent, but not necessarily global. But these things are out there. But if we become spacefaring, we'll be able to deflect these things, because you have to deflect them way out in space so that you could give them just a little nudge and then they'll miss the Earth.
So basically deflecting, is that the most realistic option to protect ourselves from asteroids?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you don't want them to hit, so you deflect them, you make them miss.
And you write that humanity's most immediate threat is not asteroid impact or climate change or resource depletion, but bad ideas. What is the worst idea that is infecting our world as we look at space and exploration?
The worst idea is that there's only so much to go around. The worst idea is that all there is here, and sooner or later we're going to have to fight over it. And so the only question is when. This is the idea that caused the great disasters of the 20th century, fundamentally at the root of it. World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, the Holodomor, and many others, they're all caused by this conceit. And it's wrong, because there isn't just so much to go around, because the Earth comes with an infinite sky.
Author Robert Zubrin says, to find answers, we're going to leave our cradle planet and have a serious look around. And there's no better place to do astronomy than space. The new book is called The Case for Space. You can join in to make your case about why or why not explore Mars and beyond. We're at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the space race of decades past? How did it change your world? Do you remember the country coming together? What space exploration events do you remember? And how do you feel when you watched a launch on television? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up in just a minute. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. We're exploring Mars, hearing why we must go there and why this would bring new hope to our world. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and aerospace engineer Robert Zubrin writes, exploring Mars will provide us the key to understanding the origin of life, which is, in fact, currently a mystery. Any way you slice it, he says, one thing seems rather certain. There are plenty of civilizations out there. What do you think these civilizations are like? What do you think they've achieved? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And Robert Zubrin stays with us. Robert, our colleagues at the best of our knowledge and here and we on The Morning Show, we've been exploring this concept of hope this month. And how is humanity's hope or that, you know, lack thereof connected to the pursuit of Mars?
Well, it's a question of how we conceive the future. Okay, once again, it is not a question that we're going to get oil from Mars or something like this, but it's a question of understanding that we're not living in a cage with only so much resources in it. You know, if you and I were stuck, were in a room and there was one bottle of water in the room, and for some reason we believed that there was no way we'd ever get out of that room, okay, then all the water that there is for us to fight over, okay, and really it's in each of our interests to try to kill the others to have that piece of water. And that's a ridiculous conceit because there's a door, and even if it's locked, the two of us working together could knock it down. But this idea that there is only so much to go around, this is the threat. I happen to know, okay, because I have talked to them, that there are people sitting in cubicles in Washington, D.C., in some very important places, who think that we must stop China from developing because if they become middle class, they'll all have cars, they'll all start using oil, and there's a billion of them, and there won't be enough oil in the world for the U.S. and China together. And you can bet your bottom dollar that there are people sitting in cubicles in Beijing today who look at the United States and think the exact same thing, okay? Mm-hmm. But meantime, there's an infinite sky above us. There's enough deuterium on Mars, but not only that, enough potential for new civilizations in space that will invent all kinds of things that will make the Persian Gulf oil seem completely irrelevant to humanity's future. It's human creativity, you know, that defines what resources are. And the more different civilizations there are contributing ideas, and the more people, and the better off they are, and the better educated they are, and the freer they are, the faster the rate of invention. And, you know, look, it's a question of how we conceive the future. In 1912, Ferdinand von Bernhardi, who was one of the chief intellectuals of the German general staff, wrote a book called Germany in the Next War. It was a bestseller. And what he basically said was this, is there's only so much to go around, okay? And so who's going to get it, us or Russia? We better knock them out now before they industrialize, because we're going to have to fight them sooner or later. And in our case, it'd be better sooner. And so they took advantage of a pretext in 1914 to initiate World War I because they conceived it as being inevitable. OK, it was a self-fulfilling prophecy. And this is the threat we face right now. We face the threat not of resource exhaustion, but people who believe in resource exhaustion. We're not threatened by there being too many people. We're threatened by people who think there are too many people. You know, take Hitler. Germany needs living space. OK, and launches campaigns to exterminate the populations of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, starting with the Jews, but then the Slavs and the rest. This was all nonsense. Germany today has a smaller territory than the Third Reich and a larger population, but a vastly higher standard of living, not because they stole anybody else's land. They didn't succeed in that, but because of the advance of human knowledge. And who advances human knowledge? Humans.
Well, let's pause right there and bring in Ryan in Beaver Dam. Ryan, hi.
Hey. I had three quick points. First, colonizing the moon would be the first best step to collect helium-3 and use it as a base to go further into space. Secondly, using like an ark where there's DNA to travel across the space to use it to then recolonize space. Also, a more efficient way to leave the planet, which would be a maglev system to get up to speed to then use rocket propulsion, would be a much more efficient way to get into space.
Thank you, Ryan. What about these efficiencies, Robert?
Moon or Mars first, that's one on which reasonable people disagree. In the book, The Case for Space, I discuss how we could colonize the moon and how we can colonize Mars. I think we should do best. I'd like to take on Mars first, because I think for us today, the challenge of Mars is equivalent to the challenge of Moon in the 1960s, and we're not going to be able to inspire the next generation by the challenge of repeating what their grandparents did. But sure, we can absolutely settle the Moon and exploit the helium-3 resources there, as the caller said. That's true. What else? DNA? In the book, I do talk about the option of sending what I call micro spacecraft equipped with miniature arcs of DNA and microbes to multiply them and take root, Noah's Ark's eggs or seeds, if you will. And that's an interesting idea for interstellar colonization. It's got its pluses and minuses. It's also discussed in The Case for Space. As for maglevs, I don't really... think so. It's a lot of infrastructure there, and the benefit you get is limited. Now, one revolutionary technology that I do talk about in the book are space elevators, and they'd be very easy to implement on the moon. These are long tethers that could be lowered on satellites, and you could travel up them from the surface by cable car and get to space without rockets at all. Putting aside my own particular skepticism of maglevs as a particular solution, the caller is absolutely right that there are potentially much more efficient ways of reaching space than the ones we have now. But I think they'll be developed in answer to the needs of a spacefaring civilization. Columbus crossed the Atlantic in ships that even 50 years later, no one would have crossed the Atlantic in. But because Europeans became transatlantic, they developed better ships and clipper ships and steamboats and ocean liners and Boeing 747s. Okay, the airplanes actually being developed by the branch of human civilization that they created on the far side of the Atlantic. But there you have it. So we're going to go to Mars with the kind of spacecraft we can conceive of now. But, you know, 50 years from now, we'll have far more advanced ways of both getting into space and traveling across space.
Robert, one of the first astronauts to land on the moon, Buzz Aldrin, is quoted on the cover of your book saying, "At last, here is the vision we were aiming for when we landed on the moon." How do people at NASA, at SpaceX, other aerospace engineers feel about this feat of going to Mars? Are you alone out there in stressing why this is necessary?
Well, no. Well, certainly SpaceX. I mean, Musk was partly recruited to the cause of humans to Mars by reading my previous book, The Case for Mars, as well as books and writings of others. But, you know, Victor Hugo said nothing can stop an idea's time has come, because the idea recruits to its banners the people to implement it. And many, many people at SpaceX are inspired by the call of turning humanity into multi-planet species. You walk into SpaceX and there's a gigantic photograph of Mars on the wall. Every employee sees it going in and coming out. And I know many people at SpaceX personally, and certainly they're all very strong supporters of this idea. This is why they're doing what they're doing. Because let me tell you, there's easier places to work than SpaceX. Musk works his people really hard, but they do it because they're motivated by a vision. They could make the same money with a much easier work schedule working somewhere else.
Well, we're down to the last few seconds, but I want to leave with this. How can it be effective in a world where we have so many other immediate pressing issues? As we listen to this conversation, why should we prioritize Mars, and what contribution can we make on the everyday level as individual human beings?
Okay, well, first of all, as I said, the intellectual capital generated by a space program and by a civilization which is looking up and not down is the intellectual capital that will solve all these mundane problems. Secondly, the biggest threat we face is from this idea that what we have here is all there is. That is the idea that threatens our civilization. That is the idea that caused the great disasters of the 20th century, and it's the idea that could cause a much bigger one in the 21st century. Having a civilization that is visibly moving into space, that it is obviously that has no ceiling on it, is the way to refute that idea. And in terms of what people can...
We have to leave it there. Robert, thank you for joining us. Robert Zubrin is an astronautical engineer, author who advocates for Mars. His new book is called The Case for Space. And together with our colleagues at To the Best of Our Knowledge, we've been exploring the concept of hope this month. You can hear more at ttbook.org/hope. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.